Let's bring in Ben Nicholson-Smith. He's co-host of our At the Letters podcast. He's baseball editor at sportsnet.ca. He live blogged last night's draft. Ben, thanks so much for joining us. Now, Travis McKenzie, my producer, showed me the video of the Blue Jays pick, who was chosen 12th overall. And as I said, I don't know if he was just surprised to go that high, because a lot of teams had him, or I should say a lot of mock drafts had him ranked as low as 31. But, I mean, I didn't detect, like I said, the kid wasn't jumping up and down and punching his, you know, throwing his fist in the air at being selected.
Right. It's funny seeing the different reactions, you know, of some of them who are completely overwhelmed with emotion, and some of the picks seem a little less surprised. My suspicion is that, you know, the Blue Jays, much like every team with their first rounders, would have had conversations with Groshans in advance about, hey, if you get to us, hey, maybe we can reach this deal. Would you be amenable to signing? That kind of thing. That's a huge part of the draft process. So I would expect that he had a pretty good idea that the Blue Jays might be taking him there.
So maybe he's a Texas Rangers fan.
He's a big Rougned Odor guy.
Yeah, maybe.
After all.
Maybe that could be the case. Tell me about this kid.
Well, it sounds like he's a big hitter. I mean, this is his calling card, and I don't know that you ever draft someone in the first round for their defense if you're a position player. So they like his bat. According to what Steve Sanders, their amateur scouting director, was telling us last night right after the pick was made, this is a guy who has power, contact ability, plate discipline. They just like his overall plate approach. So, I mean, if you have that kind of ability at 18, he's already played in a league with wood bats in some showcases and succeeded against advanced competition. And, I mean, that's pretty much as you can look for from an 18-year-old hitter. Then you get to the question of his defense, shortstop, is he going to stay there? And it's funny, you know, you look at some of the pre-draft material that's out there, and he's listed already as a third baseman. So certainly wouldn't be a surprise if he joins the ranks of, you know, the Chet Lemons and Gary Sheffields and all these guys, Chipper Jones, who are drafted as shortstops and end up playing in the big leagues elsewhere. But the real key is, if the bat takes him to the big leagues, I'm sure he'll find a spot to play.
Right. He's listed as 6'4". And, you know, that, I mean, not to say that that necessarily precludes you from playing shortstop, but at that age, it certainly suggests that there's a chance that this kid's going to be, you know, maybe develop a little more heft, put more weight on that body, and maybe end up needing a move. Although, you know, there's nothing wrong. I mean, it is another sort of common baseball thing to do, isn't it? That you naturally associate your shortstop, generally at an elite level, which these kids are, you associate the shortstop as being a pretty good athlete. So if you get a guy who's a good athlete, you can probably find a place to fit him on the diamond, especially if his bat forces his way there.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's going to be the key. And it's interesting seeing where he went in relation to where some of the mock drafts were projecting him to go. And of course, with the baseball draft, you never really know how it's going to unfold. But he was projected to go a little bit later. So clearly the Blue Jays believe in this bat more than some other teams in the industry. And ultimately, that's fine. I mean, sometimes you can be like the Astros with Carlos Correa, and it looks like a reach at the time, and it ends up being a great pick. Other times, a reach is a reach, and you shouldn't have made the pick. So it comes down to your own evaluation of these guys. And Steve Sanders, in his second draft with the Blue Jays, has made a big bet here on Jordan Groshans.
Now, as Shai points out in his article, you know, in the first couple of drafts under Ross Atkins, the three first-round picks were all college players. You know, even, and as he also points out, Alex Anthopoulos, he made high school pitchers a calculated priority. They hadn't really selected a high school player in the first round since Phil Bickford in 2013. Phil Bickford didn't end up signing with the Blue Jays. So why now? Why go the prep route now? Was it simply that they thought he was the best all-around hitter on the board?
That's my guess. And I think that when you look at the checks and balances with the MLB draft, you know, the first couple of picks offer you the chance to save a little here, spend a little there. Clearly high school players, and Groshans is committed to Kansas. So he's got some leverage there, but certainly seems like he's going to sign from what Steve Sanders was saying. But really, you're looking at the balancing act of trying to make sure that you get the right players at the right prices. And every team is going to max out their draft bonus pool. I mean, it's not a question of spending aggressively or not spending aggressively. The Blue Jays will spend what they can spend. There's no question in my mind about that. It's just which players are going to be the beneficiaries of that money. And by all accounts, you know, Groshans is someone whose bat should be a first round talent, whether you put him at the end of the first round or the beginning of the first round.
Right.
So I always tend to be a little hesitant to, you know, read too much into trends in the course of a 5-year period. I know it's a cliche, but I do believe that to some extent, these teams really are taking the best player available.
Yeah, no. And that's a good point. More than any other draft, I've had people tell me that, if a player goes in the first round, I mean, again, there are outliers for economic reasons, but you know, once you get down from the top five, you know, a guy who was there may have been somebody that might have had this guy ranked as high as the Blue Jays did, and maybe a little higher. I mean, you just don't know. Once you get past the top three or four picks, a lot of times it's just simply need, it's signability, and the main thing seems to be that, you know, if you're a first-round talent, you go, for the most part, you go someplace in the first round, right? If your bat projects as a first round, you go someplace in the first round, unless there's, you know, a reason, some off-the-field reason or something like that.
Right, exactly. Unless you've committed to play football somewhere,
right.
Unless you're a high school pick who's determined to go to college. Basically, the talented players are going to go in the first round, and just the way it lines up for the Jays, it certainly seems like they're going to be able to sign him. And then, you know, college player with the second pick, you would think that Griffin Conine is a very likely bet to sign with the Blue Jays too. So that's a nice thing for them too, because in the last 5-6 years, they've had a few top picks who don't sign with the team. Mm.
Now he's got obviously good baseball bloodlines, and the Jays do like, it seems like, the idea of getting a second generation player. Tell us a little bit about Griffin Conine.
Yeah, well, he's, as you mentioned off the top, the son of Jeff Conine, which is always interesting. Someone who was at Duke University, an outfielder, and again, by all accounts, someone who can really hit. So that's, if you have someone who's making consistent line drive contact, then that'll play. At least you would certainly think that it would. So Griffin Conine, it's amazing, just joining the ranks of so many prominent sons of major leaguers, with the Biggios and the Bichettes and of course the Guerreros. But that's one thing where the Blue Jays seem to be a little bit more, they seem to believe a little bit more in this idea that bloodlines matter. And I don't think, I mean, at a certain point, if you have 10 sons of major leaguers, that seems to be something that they're drawn to as an organization.
Yeah, I was going to say that would constitute a trend. Would think that would constitute a trend. Noah Naylor, the top-ranked Canadian in the draft, went, 23rd, I believe, overall. My computer just signed off. 23rd overall to Cleveland. Big question with him is what position is he going to play? Do you think he will also eventually end up at third base?
Well, it's funny with these guys, you know, and Naylor, catching potential, he's caught at a pretty high level already.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like when you watch the way teams handle these decisions, they give them every chance to fail. And then you keep going. And if they can sustain that production, then they'll get the chance to play at that premium position. You do get some exceptions. I'm kind of reminded of Bryce Harper here, where he was drafted as a catcher and someone who, by all accounts, could have been a really good major league catcher.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have a bat that good, it's tough to potentially only have him in your lineup 130 times a year. So
right.
if Naylor's bat is to that level, you know, that might shift the discussion a little bit. Otherwise, I think you try to get what you can out of them defensively, because there's such a difference between, you know, a 30 homer bat who can play catcher and a 30 homer bat who's a corner outfielder.
Yeah, he went, my bad, by the way, he went 29th overall. And, and as you say, and I guess this seems to be the question the Indians will be debating. You know, that bat is so good. Do you help speed along the offensive development by putting him at a position like third base, you know, as opposed to leaving him a catcher, which is going to take an awful lot of, you know, it's going to take a toll in his body and a toll in his knees. And he may want to have a conversation with Russ Martin about that particular move. Noah Naylor may want to do that. What are you expecting in the rest of the draft from the Blue Jays? Are we going to see a focus on pitching now that they've got two position players with the first two picks, or do you think it's sort of going to be just all over the place?
I'm guessing by the time we get to the end of tomorrow, so that'll be 1,200 picks in. It's amazing they still have more than 1,000 picks to go when you think about that and how much goes into each pick. But by the time those 1,000-plus picks have been made, I'm guessing that of the Blue Jays' 40, probably 20, 22 of them are pitchers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have a bunch more position players. And probably most of the position players are center fielders or shortstops or catchers, with maybe a college first baseman or two mixed in. But that's the way it seems to go just about every year. It's funny, you know, pick by pick, they say best player available, but by the end, you have that. It almost resembles a 40-man roster in a way, where about half of it ends up being pitching and half of it ends up being position players. And for the Jays, I'm sure that they're going to, you know, I'd be stunned if they don't draft 15, 20, 25 pitchers in the next couple of days.
All right. We got through a segment without talking about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. But we are going to talk about the other, the Major League Blue Jays, who opened the very brief two-game series against the Yankees tonight at the Rogers Center, CC Sabathia against Marco Estrada. You've got two games against the Yankees, four against the Orioles, and then you go into Tampa for three. This is kind of, my sense is I think we already know where the Jays stand in the American League East pecking order. I'll ask you this. What do you think management, Ben, will be looking at particularly closely over these next 2 weeks? Because there really does seem to be a sense around this team that, you know, everybody knows what's going on. Everybody knows that they've had a bunch of players playing out of position. That's changed a bit with the return of Grichuk and Diaz. But I think everybody realizes that absent really good starting pitching, this team is what it is. And everybody knows that Vladdy Jr. is going to be up at some point next year and that the whole thing is geared towards creating the right culture, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But at some point, I can't imagine this management team is just going to stand by and let this thing spiral to the point where the Jays end up in last place. I can't imagine that.
Right. Yeah. It would be a really rough few months if it went down that path. I think that as for what they're looking for in the next couple of weeks, I think a return to form from Josh Donaldson, it would be huge. And, you know, that first means he gets back on the field and returns from the DL and, you know, starts producing. But if he can do that within that 2 week time span, that would be huge just because he should be their biggest trade chip. Right now, their biggest trade chip is probably Jay Happ. Mm-hmm. And that's great. And it's a credit to Happ. And he's had a great 3-4 year run now that deserves probably a lot more credit than he gets. But if you have a former MVP on your team who still should be in his prime, that guy should be the one who is the most coveted player on your team at the trade deadline. And it's amazing, but that wouldn't be the case right now. So I think Donaldson is really the biggest variable. I mean, you can look to, you know, smaller scale changes like, hey, is Marcus Stroman going to work his way back? Is the bullpen going to recover from, you know, his period of time that's definitely been rough at times? And, you know, how are guys like Grichuk and Diaz going to reacclimate to the big league roster? But ultimately, it's Donaldson, because you could either get a really big haul for him at the trade deadline, or maybe the offers aren't there and you end up holding on to him and trying to get a compensatory pick. And there's a pretty big difference in value between those two things.